Music and People with Neil Valentine. Here's what I find fascinating about music leading, about music making. For me, it's all about music and people. These two threads I've woven together in my work over many years. Sometimes it's mostly about the music as the group are engaged, skilled, and motivated. Sometimes it's mostly about the people if group members have difficulties of various kinds. But always it's about how these two elements interact. This idea has emerged over time and has now become a core aspect of my practice as a musician. In my first orchestras, I thought it was all about me and the music and my friends, about us doing the music together, and to us it was. When I saw the wider world, through travelling, working abroad, university, postgraduate study, I saw it wasn't about music and us. It was about me trying to figure out where I was and how I fitted in. What could I offer? Where was my space? What was my niche? Some things I thrived in, others I did not. Some things I thought I would thrive in but didn't. Others I worried about but took to it like a duck to water. After South Bank Sinfonia's Watershed Education Project, I embarked on a new journey to be an animateur, a workshop leader, a music educator. I learned from other workshop leaders, working with different groups and communities. I offered up my time, eager to be part of these projects. I learned how to communicate with people, how to use my voice, how to be open to their ideas and be the spark behind their energy. Along the way, I had many important moments which shaped the way I do this work, how music and people interact and how I facilitate that. One such moment shaped how I saw myself and what I could offer, and has a major impact on how I show up now. In around 2008, I was teaching in a primary school in Walthamstow, North London. I was teaching 30 children violin all at the same time. Don't worry, it's fun, and I enjoyed the wonderfully organised musical chaos. I was working with an experienced teacher, and for some reason, she was supporting me rather than the other way around. During one lesson, I was shouting my head off. I can't remember why, but the class were just not listening. I took a few minutes to calm down, and this other teacher stepped in and very quietly and calmly refocused the class. She got them back on track by almost whispering. I was astounded. Could I be that quiet, focused teacher too? From that point on, I saw that I could use much more than my big, authoritative voice and persona to move a group forward. Being very tall and big, I'd used that part of myself to be in charge of a group. I discovered through this piece of inspiration that I could smile, flex, be open, listen, speak quietly. It was a huge lesson for me and enabled me to see beyond the surface of the group. I could now get past my own ego and see them as people. That is when I started to thrive and see these threads being woven together. Another important lesson was learning to see past the labels people are given, as I was able to do that for myself. I learnt how to do this for the people I was working with. When you are working with a group, information about them is very useful. It helps you build context, have the correct resources planned, and for the music leader to empathise with the group right from the start. However, my experiences have taught me that when I enter a musical situation, it works better if the labels are lifted, and you endeavour to work with them as you find them there, in the room, with you, on this day, at this time. I try not to have expectations beyond having a nice time and making music together. This crystallised over a few years when I led the London Chamber Orchestra community project Music Junction. The aim of Music Junction was to bring together different communities of teenage musicians and use music as a means of developing teamwork, creativity, self-confidence, break down barriers, bring people with wildly different life experiences together so they can learn from each other. These projects culminated in large-scale performances at Cadogan Hall in London, featuring over 100 young people and the full London Chamber Orchestra. To do this work well, I developed skills in holding the space, a term taken from various forms of therapy. Rita Walker, a clinical psychologist, researcher and professor at the University of Houston, describes, "Holding space for someone can mean different things for different people, but at a minimum, it means taking the initiative without any prompting, to be empathetic to another person's situation or circumstance, making time for that individual to do whatever is needed for them, like voicing hurt, anger, or another strong emotion, and receiving whatever they need to communicate in a way that is supportive and non-judgmental. For me as a music leader, working with often vulnerable groups, I must always be empathetic to the groups, their members, their communities. I must find ways to build confidence and self-expression whilst protecting their sense of themselves. I must be non-judgmental and as inclusive as I can so that all members feel equal and as safe as they can. For a music leader to be effective, they must be able to hold the space that they are working with. If you are conducting an orchestra who know each other well, then the space is already being held by the group and you become part of that space, their space. If you are teaching in a school, you will need to establish that the teachers and students know you have expertise and they can learn from you as it is their space too. An amateur choir will want a music leader who can help them develop their skills and facilitate good musical experiences in rehearsal and performance whilst keep having fun. A mark of a good workshop leader, a good musical animateur, an element which contributes towards being bomb-proof in the next episode, is the ability to hold the space no matter who you have in the room. You have the emotional, social, musical skills to create a space when any person can step in and feel like they belong on some level, that they're going to be okay, that they are welcome and should be there. I recall one session with Music Dunction in Berkshire, which included a group of young people from Bradfield College, a group from Thiel Green Community School, and a group of children from High Close School. Three wildly different schooling experiences with a huge variation in musical instrumental abilities and experiences, social skills, self-confidence. Many of the young people from High Close had significant extra needs in terms of one-on-one support for a complex range of social, emotional, and mental needs. Here we were, in a school music room, mixing four different communities and asking them to make music together. One, the highly skilled students of Bradfield College, many of them well on their way to mastering their instruments. Two, musicians from Thiel Green Community School, who were not beginners, but not even close to the same level as Bradfield. Three, young people from High Close, who were there with simple percussion instruments or just starting their journeys with music. Their teachers had chosen these students as they had seen an interest in music, which could build self-confidence engagement through this project and be hopefully life-changing. Four, the professional musicians from the London Chamber Orchestra, who were first and foremost performers. They did all teach their instruments, young people, had experience of working in this way, but they were not trained music leaders or teachers. This is useful information for me as a music leader. I knew there were these four groups, and my job was to create something meaningful that we could engage with together. I also knew that it was not just musical differences which were likely to be varied, but the social and emotional needs of everyone present. We were all in a new situation with new people doing something new, something which could be exposing. Many were self-conscious. Hormones were a factor in the teenagers as they met new teenagers from different schools and made music in front of their friends, peers and teachers. My role was to see the music and the people, to hold all the difficulties in such a way that the music and the people could come forward and be woven together by the group. To do this, I took as many barriers away as possible, in as many ways as I could. We set up in a large circle, which promotes equality and togetherness. I introduced myself to as many of them as I could before the session, asking names and trying to learn as many as I could. The members were also asked to wear name stickers to help the process. I find names are essential for someone to really feel welcomed, especially when there are anxieties and nerves swimming around. I did not use music stands or notated music. We did everything through listening, watching and learning together. This approach levels the playing field. It brings all musicians back together to experience sound as sound. It creates a sense of equality because no one knows what's going to happen. No one has a script. It will be what it will be. In these sessions, breaking the ice is essential through non-musical games and activities. Many of the ones I use are taken from the drama theatre world. They have lots of benefits. To show we are all human, to get to know and meet each other, to break up cliques, to feel safe, to have fun and bond as a group through shared experience, to have your voice heard, to feel seen, to hear each other, to see each other, smile, to have fun. The list goes on. I also use these games to build experience of some core musical skills, which I believe are essential to being a successful music group. I build three vital musical skills to help a group bond and get to know how the ensemble feels. Once these are learnt, then a group can move forward with more confidence and belief. Practicing them also gives the group a sense of who we are musically, what skills we have, and therefore where the music may go. Here are the skills that I like to build. 1. Making a sound all at the same time. A musical group becomes an ensemble when they make sound together. Using your breath and peripheral senses to follow each other, the group plays short sounds together without worrying about notes or harmony. Now we know how the group can sound. Making a sound by yourself. To know the group from the inside, you need to know what each element sounds like on its own, just as a chef needs to know which flavor tastes like individually. Each person is invited to play a sound they wish to. There are no requirements for it to be good or in tune, just that they make a sound, which they choose when they do their first solo. Lastly, following more than one thing at the same time. In a musical group, the real joy comes when more than one thing happens at the same time. That's how you get groove, harmony, texture, and melody to interact together into something magical. This experience is essential to facilitate when a group is experiencing, and there are many ways to do this. On this occasion, we passed solo notes around the circle one way, and vocal sounds the other. The two musical elements moving in opposite directions, which the group have to keep track of and help each other in the process, gives a fun and engaging game, bringing everyone together, building this skill. My role was to facilitate all of this in such a way that included everyone, built everyone up, and fostered a sense of group. The sense of wrong does not apply. The technical requirements are simple. They are open and welcoming rather than exclusionist. It does not say, you can't play a C or a D, so you can't come in. Instead, it says, whatever you can play is exactly what we need. To do this with each member, holding their doubts and worries and create a space where the whole group can work together is the essential skill which I employ. This is when you see the threads of music and people start to weave and intertwine, that patterns emerge as the group grows in confidence and each person's musical voice, personality and actions are woven together into music which only sound like them. You say yes to ideas, you build up music which grows from the group into something which is ours. When a music leader can hold the space, you are able to make it about the music and the people. You foster an atmosphere where all participants feel valued, welcome, like they belong. They are then able to offer more of themselves to interact with the music and each other. Then, it can just be about the music and the people. So, today I'm with Aga Sarugo-Lugo. Aga and I were at university together. Our careers as kind of creative musicians and workshop leaders started at a similar kind of time. At the early part of my career, Aga and I did quite a lot of work together. We haven't connected since before the pandemic, and it's an absolute delight to talk with you. So welcome, Aga. How are you doing, man?
I'm very good, Neil. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no, thank you. Thanks for coming on and making me look good, as I know you will. So how are you doing? You're currently in Suffolk. That's where we're talking to you from. You're working exactly. with Britain Peers, Snake Maltings. What are you up there to do right today?
Today, fantastically, I'm actually doing some observational stuff. Yeah, I've gotten to a part of my career, Neil, if you can imagine, that I get to look at other people and they care about my opinion.
Yeah,
which is incredible.
You know, I got there too as well. It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah. It's nice. Yeah. People pay me to just watch.
Yeah, but your opinion is valued because of your wealth of experience. So are you observing somebody who's early part of their career, or is it like a teacher? Is it like who is it you're working with?
It's actually the person who I'm observing is a workshop leader and a composer. And actually, it's part of so Britain Peers Arts have got this strategy of they do lots and lots of completely different things. And the stuff that I personally work with quite a lot with is stuff that works with children around Suffolk. But what I'm going to observe is their Aubrey Young Musicians Program, which is actually so somebody we were working with, actually relatively trained musicians, and it's not sort of a in the work areas that you and I work with, it's much more sort of hard to reach areas. It's not so much that sort of thing. It's much more sort of expanding people's musical outlook and all that sort of stuff. So it's sort of seeing how that currently works and see if it fits in with what Britain Peers Arts wants to do and be in the future.
Wow. Okay. That sounds really interesting. So you're observing a sort of a musician, composer, workshop leader who is working with, are they kind of their youth orchestra members or something like that they're kind of working with? Is that the kind of thing?
Aubrey Young Musicians is basically Suffolk-based musicians, and they apply to be an Aubrey Young musician, but it's an amazing program where they just get to do like incredible amount of stuff, like in half terms and stuff like that, where just like it might be sort of like a contemporary percussionist stuff, and they get to do like wacky rhythms for like a day, or they get to like sing like choral stuff. But the musicians themselves are from completely disparate disciplines. But they've got to show a certain amount of aptitude before they apply, and then the idea is they expand it.
That's really interesting, because like one of the things we're going to talk about is the idea of holding the space, and like in that kind of context, you've got all these disparate. So I'm guessing disparate musicians. We're talking like there's going to be rock musicians, there's going to be guitarists, yep. They're going to be clarinetists. There might be a classical singer, or maybe even a DJ or a rapper or something. So the person leading it will have to find a way of bringing all of those kind of people together. Which is, if you were in that person's shoes this afternoon, what would your train of thought be to like? Bring, because you might know roughly who's going to be there, but you won't know exactly. It's half term, anything can happen. You never know who's going to show up in a lot of these things. So what would your process, what would your thoughts be if you were going to be leading this kind of thing?
There's obviously lots of variables. I mean, one of the big things is the age. They're teenagers. So I almost always start with a little bit of a chat at the beginning with teenagers. I've got it's a silly thing, but it's usually it's more revealing than asking people about what you do and all that sort of stuff. I always ask people what their favorite film is, or a film in their top five. And it usually, even if they are not sure what they're going to say, it instigates a chat and discussion, and it reveals something about their character and also other people's reactions to their film. Or non-film choice usually reveals something about their character. And actually, by the time you've gone around the whole group, there is a slight bond that's formed from just having just revealed a slight bit about yourself. And that's something. And usually, that's something I would only do really with that age group, with teenagers. Mm-hmm. It's not something I would do with like primary age or so. And obviously, with a smaller group, you wouldn't do it with like, 100. Because that's the entire workshop. Then for me, like a warm up exercise is usually quite. I mean, one of the things you're trying to do is effectively create your own in that moment, create your own ensemble, create your own little mini community, and for us to feel like we're just working together. So that warm up is also a nice like a bonding thing. And I always start with like some sort of energizery type activity, something physical, something facial.
You have what do you do? What's your top? What's your go-to energizer?
I've stolen quite a lot of stuff from you. I think you do. there's all the sort of copy me. There's the do as I say, not as I do. And you put your hand in your head, and you put your hand in your knees, and all that sort of stuff. And do as I do, not as I say. People love that. If it depending on the size, you can make them into a circle. People love pass the clap. People love pass the stamp. Pass the eagle. Ah, and all that sort of stuff.
That's good. I've done pass the eagle.
Have you not done pass the? Oh, I try to incorporate as many animal sounds as possible.
I remember. Actually, that's interesting, because one of the things I struggle with sometimes is I use this game where you send a clap around one way and then a vocal sound around the other, and with teenagers. Yes. I always, especially teenage boys, you're never sure what vocal sound to do because you want something which is going to like stretch the voice slightly so that they feel like they can communicate. But so an eagle sounds quite good because it's like it does that kind of like the high thing that you want it to do,
exactly.
But it's also under the cover of something else. So I quite like that. That's quite clever.
Totally. Eagles, cows, people love it with a bit of sign going on at the same time. They love all that sort of stuff. It's part of the energizer, but just as a focus thing. Sometimes if they're just not with you right at the beginning, even just trying to clap at the same time. That's a pretty standard one. For this age group, I wouldn't do the classic rubber chicken. That's more primary, but that's sort of in your arsenal as well. And then
it's the kind of thing you can pull out, isn't it? Like
you've slumped and you're like, right, we're going to do this really silly thing. Especially once you've got you can see that the fun is starting to be had, and it's like nearly there. And you can like okay, we're just going to do this really silly thing. You know, the circle thing's interesting because I was talking with a colleague of mine yesterday for another episode called Sam Mason. And she is she will do circle-based games, you know, in infinite variations. What is it? And like you use circles. Are you like most workshop leaders that we know set up if the space allows, will set up in a circle. What is it, do you think? Why is it that we do that? Why is that like the go-to shape for working in this way?
Well, I suppose inclusivity is one of the words that's basically going to use for much of this conversation. You can see everybody is the first thing. They can see each other. And you, I think for me, the most important thing is you've not actually set yourself, because I describe myself, I self-identify as a workshop facilitator.
Right.
I think facilitator is an important word as opposed to leading. Obviously, there are moments when you are leading, but actually the best, the most successful, the most productive workshops that I've been involved in, you basically engender a condition where everybody feels a part of something and you're facilitating the happening that we're all creating. And circle is a perfect shape for that. It feels as though I am a part of the workshop as opposed to leading the workshop. So I think that's kind of why circles are...
Everything. It kind of evens it out, yeah. So you're facilitating, but you're as much of a participant as everybody else. So it's really interesting. Yeah.
I did a workshop, it was a week Saturday, and it was just this beautiful, it was in Worcester, it was this beautiful, I can't remember the name of the school, but it's like one of the oldest schools in the country. I think like there are parts of that school that were around during Henry VIII's time. School. Yeah. But the point of my workshop, it was like leading to a wider project where they were going to perform something called Mass in Blue, which is like a blues mass.
Okay.
Five schools come. It's a Saturday, so they would come voluntarily, but it was, the room was set up like essentially like assembly with chairs.
Yeah.
So they were all sat on chairs, like facing me, and there was a piano there. I was asked if I needed a stand, music stand. It's so interesting. It was like immediately, and I think if they had asked me this 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have had the courage, especially after somebody told me this is such an old school. I probably wouldn't have had the courage to say, do you know what, this setup is not working. But I was kind of like, I'm certainly not going to need a stand. Those chairs need to move, and we just need to make it so that we couldn't make a circle, but we made a huge semicircle feel, and we brought them closer.
Yeah.
And immediately everybody was much more relaxed.
Yeah.
And immediately the dynamic was not, I'm going to teach you stuff. The dynamic is, we're going to share creativity together. And that's what you
Yeah, you're facilitating what's going to happen rather than doing music to them. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting that. I mean, because so another big part of your work is working in SEND, special needs kind of schools. You've done that for years, haven't you? You've worked in those kind of settings. Yeah. So if we're talking about setup, so I agree with you, setup's really important. And as I've got more in my career, now you just go in and go, no, we're going to set it up like this, and you don't give them any other choice because you know it's going to work. Or you kind of, the person who set it up for you, they're thinking on a different level to you, aren't they? So if you're going into a special needs school, what are your thoughts on kind of setup? How are you going to like begin the preparation of a set? What things are going through your mind when you're?
So again, going through the variables, obviously, because if you're in a school, you're in a slightly different setting in that you'll have teachers and undoubtedly there's an army of teaching assistants that are with you. And I think it's really important that they enjoy it as much as the kids, because actually it's that thing of that whole room feeling as though we're all a part of something. And actually if the teachers enjoy it, but you've got like five teaching assistants who look bored, actually that is transmitted to the children. You're obviously in a school, so you're working with either classrooms. Almost always classrooms, but sometimes they'll put you in the school hall if it's a larger group, but usually it's in the classrooms. The other variables are obviously where the kids are at in terms of what their special needs are. Because obviously with some schools, I mean, children are simply on like the autistic spectrum. And so actually there are some workshops within an SEN setting that are not massively dissimilar to something that I would do in a primary school, secondary school, etc. But that ranges from PMLD, which I can never remember the words, but I think it's physical and mental learning.
Found.
So and PMLD is much more like, from my perspective, is much more like music therapy. So in a PMLD setting, I would have, we'd have the circle. Each child would have a teaching assistant with them. We would set up an ostinato. I would usually, and this goes, I should mention this, in SEN settings, I've usually got a djembe with me.
Right.
Because I find it's the most, my voice in the djembe is like the most useful thing in an SEN setting. Sometimes I use the piano, but I found djembe even more useful. You set up an ostinato that that the teaching assistants and the teachers can be a part of. If you engage quite early, if they're comfortable singing, but you add a vocal aspect to the ostinato that's just super simple, two notes, three notes, that keeps going. And then what I do is I go from child to child and try and get a response from each child that sits on top of the ostinato, but the ostinato keeps going. You might, as you go around, just to make it more interesting for people, that ostinato might evolve, but it essentially, from a basic level, it's essentially a giant simplified jam.
Yes,
a jam where the point of the jam is that you're setting up something so that you can get responses, particular responses from each child, and you personally. Often, unless you know that school loads or those children loads, you personally won't be the person who knows exactly what is a great response.
Yeah.
But the teaching assistant next to them will know that something's happening, and that's essentially it.
So when you're going around, I mean, there's the walking around with a djembe, that's difficult.
Yeah.
But then you're like, so you'll go around and you'll sing to a child, say their name is David. You're going to sing something like, "Hello, David," or something like to them.
Yeah.
And then to try and see what happens, and then you're just gonna. That's really interesting. It's great.
But you would do it for each, because by and large in a PMLD session you've probably got not much more than 6-7 kids. So you are talking about spending a good 5 minutes with each child,
as
that is going. So it's not just "Hello, David." It's "Hello, David, David, hello, David," and it goes on for ages.
Yeah.
And
really interesting.
So, what's your feedback been from teaching assistants? Because I'm obviously, you know, I've, you know, worked in similar settings, and you know, sometimes you get that's the most, you know, a child moves their arm and they're like, that's the most we've seen them move for 6 months. And you get those kind of amazing things. But what do they say, like, what's the kind of a more common response from the teachers? You know, why do you keep going back? Why is it do they keep getting you back in? What do they say?
As I say, each teaching assistant will know particular children particularly well, and so they'll be able to see something like, for example, let's use this David as the example. David's eyes looking from side to side, in a way that's obviously recognizing that he's enjoying something. That's what he does. Or you'll get some of them, they only like move their left leg when there's a stimuli that's really enjoying it. And they will say to you, we might get this like once a week, twice a week, and actually, but it's consistent when you come.
Nice. Yeah.
Or you might get some of the things you get from them is that the response comes when you've gone.
Right.
So you have sung a thing that goes over and over and over again, and then you return the next week, and then the teaching assistant says to you that David sings this little tune on the bus when he's going home. And it's the same thing that you've been singing over and over again, and so that's great. I mean, those are the moments. I mean, one of the best moments. It's actually relatively early on in me working SEN settings. I worked in this great primary school that actually in that primary school didn't have PMLD, but there are lots of people on the autistic spectrum that are. Lots of kids who either chose not to speak, or depending on how they've been diagnosed, like couldn't speak. They were on that sort of level, but it was various different classes. And there's this one girl. It was over a year worth of stuff. And she looked so bored throughout every session. so bored. It's like, you are clearly the most disinterested person in this room. But then, like, after knowing her for a year, and that I would be there, I think at that time I was there every other Thursday. We did this exercise with the little sort of chime bells. I don't even remember what they're called. They go dong. So they would play them, and then we'd pretend that they were microphones, and then sing into them. Now this was there were probably about 7-8 in this class. We're in quite a pokey room, which is actually not an ideal setting, but that's another matter. So we'd hit it, and then try to sing the note.
Yeah,
and for those the most of the kids in the room were comfortable singing, they would have a go, and some of them would sing it accurately, and some of them would just, and you'd actually say, you know, what's just a little bit lower, it's a little bit lower. They loved it because it's like respite from just singing all the way through it, like a song. Anyway, this girl just usually doesn't make any sounds at all, and so she picks up this chime, plays it. And then I ask her to sing into it like it's a microphone, and she goes, and everybody was like, it's like, what's going on? What is this magic? Yeah. So I think one of the things as a facilitator that goes into schools is just the fact that you're new.
Yeah.
You show the school, in particular music, but often, like, lots of these schools don't really have like a music specialist. So the fact that you're bringing music to the school is often like a great novelty anyway. But even if they do have music to the school, you provide a totally different perspective on what music is and can be and can do. And you surround them with that context, and you fingers crossed, hope for the best. But actually, over time, it is guaranteed to bring something out of them.
It's really interesting because I have a similar viewpoint that I always try when I go in and see the people I'm working with as people. Like, you know, you've got the music and you've got the people, and you're not seeing, like, that child that you're talking about there, you're not seeing her as her difficulty and her as her disability. Each week you're seeing her as a person. And the opportunity for her to express herself has always been there. And and consistently over time, you've kept offering it and offering it and offering it. And at some point, she's felt comfortable enough to, or has put the effort. She decided, oh, I can do this now. That's really kind of interesting.
Yeah. In that room, she's a fellow musician.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And like, going back to your comment on the teaching assistants, is that how you view them as well? Because you don't view them as, you're there as a teaching assistant, sit there and be a teaching assistant.
No.
But you said you want them to take part, so.
Yeah, they've got to play. They get a djembe or a musical instrument or, you know, a tambourine, and we're all in the room part of it. And you notice when because you only need one person who's not doing it. Obviously, it's different when it's the children, because, you know, there's different reasons why a child's not doing something. I'm not saying, I'm not going in there as like sort of Stalinist, you must do this. But if there's a teacher, stroke teaching assistant, who's not doing it, it totally begins to suck out the life and the dynamism of your session. And so it's absolutely vitally important that everybody in the room is a part of that moment and a part of that music making, else it doesn't work.
So if I'm a bit honest here, so when I've done work like that that you're describing, there's been a part of me which has always thought a little bit like, what is the point of you doing this? Because you go in and you have a nice time, and then you go away in, and then you go in, you have a nice time, and then you go away again. But you don't get the same, well, the rewards are in a different kind of form, aren't they? It's not like in a, you know, in a primary school where you go in and you make a piece and you do a big performance and then whatever, and there's the thing. So do you get, do any of your sessions, do you get that kind of voice in your head which kind of like goes, oh, this is the, you're not very good at this one, or why are you doing this one rather than somebody else? And how do you combat those kind of things?
I mean, I'm very comfortable in my own world. So it is rare. it is rare that I doubt myself in that sort of way. I'm perfectly happily making my own, happily sit in my own fantasy land and just keep going. I'm a bit like, I mean, in a session, I'm a bit like a sort of train, and you just keep going, carry on regardless. I mean, I have had sessions where there's been seven kids at the start and one by the end. And they've had to leave for various reasons. And some of the reasons were used, like, this is too loud for you. Like, or you know, it just, you know, and some of the children, you try as much as possible to make a session work for everybody in the room, but undoubtedly there are sounds that are going to either trigger or just or just children are just uncomfortable with a particular sound, or, you know, and this doesn't, it's not just SEN, you don't know what the children come with in terms of their own issues. This is a bit more, I mean, it is relevant in SEN settings, but, like, I do lots of stuff with Streetwise Opera, which is working with homeless people. And so you are always acutely aware at the start of the session that people are coming at that with their own issues and stuff like that. So even what to you, quote unquote, is a bad session, where you feel like someone has, you felt like you've not particularly held space and someone's sort of broken the moment and they feel uncomfortable and they're sort of blaming you for their discomfort, you do have to take two steps back, like, mentally, and say, well, do you know what? That person may have, you know, it was raining last night and that person has probably spent the entire night wet, like, undercover, like, underneath a bridge somewhere. And they've come in and they are, understandably, they need a moment to just unload. And so if you always within you have that perspective and that angle of things, of like, it may be you, but very often you're just there, you're a vessel for a wider thing. Then it helps with your personal mental health.
So can we talk a bit about Streetwise Opera? So I haven't worked for Streetwise Opera, but I've worked for Crisis. And so it's similar kind of clientele. So I know what you're saying, but can you just talk me? So when you go and lead a Streetwise Opera session, what's the setup? Like, who are you, do you get, have you got somebody working with? Like, what's the setup? What's your thought process in, like, preparing and getting yourself and the session ready to go?
So Streetwise Opera is quite an interesting, quite unique. So it's working with people who have experienced homelessness. So not everybody at the session is necessarily at that time homeless.
Yes.
It operates in London, Manchester, and Nottingham, and within each city, there's two types of sessions. There's the drop-in session, which is exactly as it sounds, and they are episodic. And so if you've never been to a Streetwise Opera session, you're absolutely welcome to just come in and all that sort of stuff. And then they have their explore sessions, which are a core group that they work with regularly. And so that's got a longer commitment if you're a participant to it. But they also do bigger projects and will perform... They perform at plays, well, in the London sessions, like Festival Hall, or maybe at the Paul Hamlin Hall at the Royal Opera House, or just sort of outside South Bank Centre, etc., that sort of thing. We do a lot of stuff. It's gone through a lot of iterations over the, obviously with COVID, everything's gone a bit belly up and that sort of stuff. The sessions pre-COVID used to be, we followed an opera. Often they would go to see an opera at the Coliseum. And then we would look at different parts of that opera, like maybe learn like some chunks of an aria. But the main meat of Streetwise is them devising stuff.
Response.
Yeah, exactly. Their response to it. So making their own pieces where we've looked at a scene from an octave, or we looked at the dynamics between two characters, and we make up our own, say, king and pauper, and what would this king sing? Let's make up our own song, all that sort of stuff. And usually at the end of the term, they would perform something from that.
Let's go back to the drop-in sessions. So I'm really interested in like the nuts and bolts of how, because you said like anyone can turn up, right? So can you walk me through? So you arrive, I don't know, half an hour earlier, say. You, I'm guessing you meet like a key worker or a case
support worker,
and they give you what, an idea of who might come. Like how do you set up the space? What and how do you? The next thing, second question is, when people start to arrive, what is it that you do to help everyone feel like they're welcome here? Because you said, you know, people have come in with their own stuff. You don't know what they've come in with. But and you know, so what is it that you do to make them come in and then stay and not turn around straight away and walk out?
Right. So it would be, so you arrive. The ones that I've done most drop-ins are at the Passage, which is just around the corner from Victoria. You'd arrive. So session would typically be a drop-in session. So typically, let's say 1:30 till 3:30. So I would arrive at the Passage about half hour early, so about 1 o'clock, and I would meet the either key worker or support worker there, and they would help me set up the room. There'd be a room with again, it would be in a sort of circle, which you usually have some sort of flip chart up. Sometimes, depending on where the drop-in centre is, there might be some small percussion light at the side. At the Passage, what we used to do is, because it was at 1:30, we would go into like the lunch counter and announce that we were doing a session. It would be every, I think it was Wednesdays when we did it, and we would announce that we were doing the session. Sometimes we do like a sort of flash mobby type performancy type thing. I should have said before, Streetwise almost always, in terms of facilitators, there's two of them usually.
Okay.
And it's in a typical Streetwise opera session.
And so you could do a version of something together.
Yes, a version of something together. Sometimes they were, I mean, because I'm not an opera singer, so often my role is to play piano, and but I like teach singing, so play piano and also help with the composition stuff when they're creating something devised. I'm also love like sort of theatre and all that sort of stuff. So I've got like a ton of ideas about devising scenes and all that sort of stuff. So if we were doing a flash mob with me, it would be often be, let's say it was myself and Nicola. Nicola's a brilliant soprano, Nicola Weidenbach. So she would sing something with me playing piano and me supporting her in some sort of way. And then maybe we'd both sing something together as a sort of flash mobby thing, and then we'd head off to the other one. So if you're interested, then come along. Even though it's a drop-in center, because you would go to the same center repeatedly, you still would get some people who are regularly there. So we'd often have a theme for the term or half term, and so there were people who would come back regularly. So you wouldn't now, and so there would be, it'd be rarely have someone who would go all the way through the whole term, but you would still have, you would have people who were there for like, you know, 5-6 sessions, and those sort of people would overlap. So you're never starting from you're rarely starting from absolutely nothing in a drop-in session. And then as I said with previous sessions, that the warm-up is quite key. Then being in a circle and then doing an interest, and then because you've said you, and I try, like, I usually refer to myself as Streetwise as opposed to Streetwise opera, because the opera word psychologically is a little bit of a barrier for lots of people. So we would do a simple song at the beginning that was fun, that was definitely not in the genre.
Yeah.
And that eases people and all that sort of stuff. And it's really useful if it's in keeping with whatever theme is you're going to focus on. So, for example, if it's like a love scene that you're going to focus on, or you do some sort of fun, cheesy love song that expresses exactly the same sentiment, you can obviously link it in with the main part of the session, which is great. And then what you do is you might I'm working with Nicola, you might get Nicola to sing a little bit that we're focused on, and then get the participants to learn like eight bars of it as it is, and then we would move the chairs out and devise a scene that recreates with the dynamics that are in the original opera, and then you could do it all sorts of ways. There's a great fun game where you you get one of the participants to be the interviewer. So people just improvise. Here's the scenario. You're this and you're that. Blah, blah, blah. This person's got a rose. It goes up, and then the rest of them get to choose when you freeze frame. So they freeze frame, and then the interviewer gets to interview one of the characters. What are they thinking at the moment?
Nice.
Exactly. And that's quite nice if you're thinking of it from a devising perspective. You might write down what those responses are, and that's the material for the song that you're going to make later in the session.
Yeah, so you're kind of like, you're putting them on the spot, but in a kind of a safe way, and they've just got to improvise, and often you get really good ideas, don't you, from that?
Totally.
People aren't worried about what they're going to say, they just have to say something, and you just kind of
exactly.
go straight into the idea.
And there's no right or wrong, emotional response to that moment. So even if it's a bit like what is that? You can use that, can't you? You can flip it, because the magic of song and art in general is that something that's contradictory is super super interesting. So you jot all that down, and maybe using a part of the motif of the original thing, you might start devising a song using their responses and stuff like that, and recreating the scene.
When you're doing that,
I'm going to make a wild assumption that you don't plan all of those things in advance. You've set the session up, you set the circle, you've got the flip chart, you've got the bit of music that you're going to use, you've got the song that you're going to teach at the start, and then, like you've said, that you run, you're a bit like a train when you're leading a workshop. You like just press go. Yeah. And then, are you running then on kind of instinct? Are you like, you're like kind of going, and then you're teaching them, and then someone comes up with an idea, and you're like, right, let's go with that one. Like, how are you?
Actually, because there's two of you in a Streetwise Opera session, more so than quite a lot of sessions, we do actually plan roughly what we think's going to happen. So, it might be like the objective is that we get this, they learn this chunk of this, this chunk of this aria, we won't overly plan, exactly how the scene's going to go, but we will plan that there's going to be scene setting, there's going to be drama, and we're going to set it out, and we will plan that we'll devise something, but we don't overly plan what the outcome has to be.
Sure.
That's yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's almost like you're... Because you have to consider the other person you're working with, don't you? You have to, you're kind of treating them like you want you and them to be participants as well. So
yeah,
if you just kind of go like a train and you don't involve them in the planning, then you can kind of cut them out, I guess, can't you?
Yeah.
Which is obviously you want to avoid.
I should say to you as well, Streetwise have got this new thing called Street Song. Which I'm involved with, which is actually just like going on the street with a keyboard and just songwriting with people on the street, which is amazing because obviously your theme is holding the space. I just thought it's interesting from Streetwise's perspective, and as my perspective as someone who's worked with Streetwise, that's a totally, that flips the concept of holding the space because I have to, so I go with a support worker, someone from Connections. Usually they, because they know the area, so it's with them. Connections based in St. Martin's in the Field, and so we're going around sort of Tottenham Court Road, Oxford Street, that sort of area, Chinatown in London, and obviously the space in question is their space.
Yes. Yeah.
So which is something, and this is Street Song is new to Streetwise. And it's a very new concept to me in that I, and almost undoubtedly in all the sessions that I do, I create, as we've discussed before, we set up the space, the physical space, in order that you can create the sort of mental space in which everybody's comfortable. Whereas this is almost like the opposite. I am asking to be invited into their space,
yeah.
And then you're going to try and make the happening. And that's okay. And so I did one on Monday. That was my third session. So I've only done three. It's great. You go out for like 2.5 hours. There's a lot of walking.
It must be exhausting.
Like the emotional toll of that kind of, like I can imagine the anxiety, like you're walking around, there's got to be a bit of your brain that's going, what am I doing here? You know, they're looking at me funny. They're going to say no. Like at the very least, they're going to say yes under duress, just so that you'll then leave them alone quicker. And at the worst, they're going to shout at you in the face and scream you down the road and you're going to be running, you know, so you must have those thoughts. Like, how do you kind of combat that?
I mean, thus far, they've all been rather polite when they've told me to go away.
not today, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And again, going back to that previous point about you don't know what they're coming with. Obviously, you have an idea. Yeah, what they're coming with, but obviously I'm not going to like push. But so when I've gone out there, I've gone out with a keyboard and a cajon, and the cajon is really great because it's firstly it's a conversation starter. What is that?
Well,
it's a cajon, and you just and then you tap it, and you say, "What do you want to tap? Have a go," and it's got a different sound there. And that starts the conversation and that sort of stuff. And then the person who I'm working with from Connections, often because they often have like money to buy them like a coffee or or breakfast or whatever, which is obviously a great way in. I usually say, so I never use the opera word. I work with Streetwise, and I do storytelling with music.
Yeah. Okay.
So what I wanted to do with you is if you don't mind, it'd be great if you can come up with like a story or a character, and then we'll just sort of shape it and see if we can turn it into something.
Right. So you're asking them for their help in a way. You're not like saying, exactly, here, I'm gonna do music to you. You're saying, I'm trying to do this thing. And I work with Streetwise.
Please help me out.
Can you help me out on it? That's interesting.
No one's going to pay me unless you help me out.
Essentially. Go on,
Gary. Just before I forget, the really important thing is that I have to immediately, once I've asked, I have to sit down on the same level as them.
Right.
Because if you're stood hovering over the top, you've got exactly the wrong dynamic immediately.
Yes.
And similarly, because I've got a cajon, I actually don't sit on it for long, because you're if they're on the ground, you're still over the top of them, which is totally the wrong dynamic. So you've got to get that keyboard out as soon as possible, so you're sat on the ground, and then it feels as though we're working together.
It reminds me a bit of, so one of the bits of work that I've done quite a lot of, which in one of the other episodes, I talk about the kind of anxieties I get, which is working in hospitals and going round. And so it just reminds me quite a lot of, so I open the door to a ward and I stick my head round, and the ward sister looks at me and says, "Not today, thank you," because of like the intrusion into her world that I kind of might bring.
Totally.
Do you get that kind of thing?
That factor. Totally. And I'm, you have a set of questions that you would ask that are kind of like can we talk and all that sort of stuff. But if somebody says, like not today, you might have some follow-up questions, but you're not going to push it so much that you actually intrude. It's kind of like, it's their life. And the entire point is that you want to aid and if you being there is not going to aid, and that's fine. But then there are sometimes when you can see that their no is what is this?
Yeah.
And you can sometimes, not sometimes, a lot of the times, you can see the difference between an outright no, I've had a really terrible night, or week, or month. And you can see the ones that's kind of like, well, maybe, what is this? And often, like, the eyes flicker from side to side. What is this? With a little bit of intrigue. And the moment you get a little bit of intrigue, when we did it on Monday, there was one guy, he's an artist, and he had his sketch pads and stuff and paintings and stuff stolen in the night. And so Paddy, who was with me, said, I actually got him breakfast and actually went round to... like a shop round, we were near Tottenham Court Road, so shop round the corner and just got another pad and some crayons. So whilst he was getting him breakfast, I asked him if he fancied doing some songwriting, and I said, well, can we just like, and I said, well, it's about storytelling, and he said, well, I don't know, so we just used the I don't know response as the start of the song. Yeah. And just basically every response that he gave just went in the song. It was just a ridiculous song. Anyway, then he had a hot chocolate and some porridge. And then Paddy went to go and get him the sketches. And it was only when, because the key worker knew him and knew that he painted, because he often got the sketches around him. It was only when Paddy had introduced the idea of the fact that he's an artist, suddenly this guy who was quite sleepy in that first song was like wide awake because he wanted to talk about art.
Yeah.
So that second song, the option with a street song, if you can, with whatever participant you've got, if you can get to two songs, and by songs I mean like four lines, whatever, but if you can get to two songs, that second song is always more meaningful. And that was about his response to what he likes to draw and like his response to them. And it was like, but he just like, was like a different person, like totally awake and totally like engaged in the whole process. And then some of them are like, some of them in their spare time write like poetry or whatever. And one of the participants actually had a poem that they were really keen to turn into a song. But she would only do it after we'd played some like late 90s, early naughty dance stuff first.
Nice.
Which yeah. I was like, you don't have to ask me twice.
Yeah, twice, yeah. Let's get our Destiny's Child on. Yeah.
We did that for 5-10 minutes. And then she got a little pad that she had. And then we turned that poem into a song. And that was great.
So this work, I mean, just like finally, before we wrap up, this work sounds really intense. That sounds really intense work. How do you like on Monday, how did you decompress after that? Because it must be like you get back to the office, you put the keyboard away, you look at the key worker and you're like, some of that was pretty intense. Mm-hmm. Like, especially when you're dealing with this kind of vulnerability, not just theirs, you know, offering breakfast and coffee and that, and the power dynamics of up and down, but also yours, like your, you know, anxieties. How do you decompress after that kind of stuff?
The advantage with Street Song is that I've complained about these long walks that involved. They are long. So there is a bit of decompression between each participant, because you've got to find the next one, and that kind of like you with whomever you're with, you can sort of analyze what's happened, and sometimes you get a bit more backstory about that participant if the key worker has worked with them quite a lot before. So there is time in the session to between, because it maybe like half an hour between each thing until you find the next person, and then also the other thing, I usually use public transport to most of my sessions, so that tube journey home is quite a lot of like, I don't like to do anything work related, like I'm just like listening to a podcast or whatever, and just like just thinking about. There was one, I tell you, one of the most moving things was the first time I did Street Songs. This is like 6 weeks ago. And it's with participants who I've actually worked with since now. I've done three. There's one person who I've seen in all three of them. who it sounds as though they might have found like accommodation actually in the last session, which is great. Anyway, it's a couple and they've got their tent and a dog, and it's her that wants to do the session. He just sort of like walks around and like sort of pretends I'm not there, which is quite funny. I'm talking about holding the space, and like I'm so clear that I'm essentially like in your house doing like a song session. But the most moving thing, it was so interesting. The dog like weed on the pavement, and he got up from his fold-up chair, and he had this bottle of water that was ready to clean it, and then he had a broom that he only used for this purpose to wipe it away. And if ever, and I've worked with Streetwise Opera for now 8 years, and as I say, in a normal Streetwise Opera session, you create the physical space and the mental space, and the people are invited into there, and hopefully they feel welcome and all that sort of stuff. And so I've worked with people who've experienced homelessness for a long time, but to be there and actually see something that was a proper experience of someone's home. That was someone that was like, this has happened. I've got this set up to deal with that. And just watching him like deal with it and wipe it away was so humbling and so like, oh my goodness, that talk about that sort of Englishman's castle and all that sort of stuff. Like it was just like, yes, this is the space that you have created. And there are, just like my home, which has this physical bricks and all that sort of stuff, there are rules and regulations like that are absolutely set up. And I was just like, I without doing that project, I would never have noticed that. I would just see a guy with a dog.
Yeah.
This is a guy with a dog who's got this whole setup to look after the dog and make sure his effective porch is clean always.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
It's great.
That's really, that's, yeah, as you say, humbling and moving. I can imagine what sitting there watching it and trying to work out and then seeing what's, and then he pulls out the brush and you're like, I mean, I've got a brush that I sweep my kitchen floor with. That's its only job. And it's the same thing. Same deal. Man, that's really, really interesting. Look, Aga, thanks so much for your time. You've got your Always session later to go. Really great to see you. Thanks very much for taking some time out to talk to me on this stuff. I've really enjoyed that. So, yeah, thanks very much.
Amazing.
That was Aga Sarugo-Lugo. Thanks so much to Aga. I hope you enjoyed listening to him talk. He's so charismatic and passionate about what he does. I really enjoyed talking with him and reconnecting. Thank you for listening to Music and People with me, Neil Valentine, and I hope you have a really good rest of your day.